This is Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. I'm Guy Rothbun in conversation with sociologist Jerry Lemke. His book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. Lemke is a professor at Holy Cross College, Massachusetts, and a Vietnam War veteran. His previous books include The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. In the first installment of this discussion, we talked about post-traumatic stress disorder, how the diagnosis has morphed over the years. Now, we spend more time on the post-war medical treatment for traumatic brain injury. I really appreciate you taking this additional time. Thank you.
I'm glad to have a chance to talk about some of the important things that we didn't talk about in part one.
I would like to, in fact, spend more time on something that those familiar with PTSD and related injuries are going to understand this, but it developed only in the last 20-some-odd years, 25, and that is what's now referred to as traumatic brain injury. That is getting a lot of press.
Oh, it really is. And when it began to get a lot of press, I can't say it took me by surprise because I thought that had been there all along, you know, as a kind of a subset of categories within PTSD. And, you know, it probably went back to the Vietnam War years treating Vietnam veterans. As I do things, I always like to look into the history of things and to see when it first began to be used. And I was really surprised, really blown away by the fact that TBI had very little presence in either the media or in the professional literature in any form until the 1980s, and none whatsoever connected to war veterans up until these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So even though all those years that PTSD developed as a concept applicable to Vietnam veterans, there was no TBI, no traumatic brain injury at all in there. So that then really gave me something else to work on, you know, when and why when TBI came into play as a war trauma designator.
It all began realistically in looking back at the trajectory of our understanding of TBI with football players. But then in the late 90s, that was seen as butting heads injury. Then in the beginning of the Iraq War, a very prominent newsman for ABC was injured as he was in a Humvee. From that came a massive amount of press coverage.
Right. And I think the kind of the larger point there that I do develop in the book, and I hope readers can follow it, is that there's a real intermingling of popular culture and news culture with medical culture, diagnostic culture. And there are books, other books that are written about this point in particular, but oftentimes it is things in the larger societal development that trigger the thinking of medical people that then, you know, moves on into some kind of new diagnostic thinking. And oftentimes it involves celebrities, it involves popular culture figures, people who are in the news. One of the things I pick up on in the book is the Central Park jogger in the 1980s, the woman who was badly beaten up there. And that is really the first really big time that TBI breaks into news coverage. And then, as you say, with National Football League players, particularly with quarterbacks, there's another spike in interest in it. And then the really big one for war and TBI is with Bob Woodruff, the ABC newsman who was wounded by a roadside bomb in Iraq early in 2006. And then, again, sort of underscoring the importance of the media and popular culture angle on this. And, you know, his wounding got a lot of attention because he was a news person. But about a year went by then until his book came out in February of 2007, a book about his wounding that was co-written with his wife, Lee Woodruff. And then there was a news conference about the book. And the news conference headlined the importance not only of the book, but the news conference headlined an ABC documentary that was coming out a few days later. So this was a news conference about an ABC program that was based on a book written by Bob Woodruff. After that news conference, TBI stories just really spiked. There was about a dozen within the next month or so after that press conference. And not only news stories, but then about 2 years later, which is about as quickly as something new can begin to get into the medical journals, a huge spike in war-related TBI began to appear in the medical journals. And I found that, of course, by using the various search engines for the medical journals. So it really becomes a case study in the relationship between news culture, popular culture, and medical culture. I'm going to be real interested to see how reviewers, how news people also respond to this, because I think I really nailed something there, particularly on the angle of TBI and war industries, that can also be used as a case study in the larger literature of medical diagnoses and larger societal culture.
Something we should discuss, we touched upon this in our earlier portion of interview, that is the number of troops who were injured in Iraq or Afghanistan over the course of those wars to today, and the number who have been treated for injuries, almost 10 times difference, 23,000 compared to 200,000 treated.
Right. Those are two different counts, actually. The first one, the lower one, 23,000, is a Department of Defense counting. The larger one, 200 and some thousand, which I guess is a factor of 10, is a Veterans Administration. The difference there is almost totally due to the Veterans Administration counting PTSD and TBI diagnoses as war wounds. The Department of Defense not wanting to do that. That's, of course, related to something I talked about in part one as to whether or not trauma or PTSD is entitled to a Purple Heart Award. Is it indeed a wound or not? As of right now, it is not. There's been some controversy over that. There was 3 or 4 years ago, I think, an attempt to make that change in how Purple Heart Awards were made, but that effort failed. So as of now, psychological diagnoses or trauma diagnoses are not countable as wounds.
Well, this is something you brought up that is striking. I had never run across, and that is in the modern warfare and the explosive devices that are triggered so easily by the Humvee, where you have five soldiers in the Humvee, and yet the average, those who died in those events, one. But they're offset by 20 injuries, yet there were only five soldiers.
Right. That also really caught my attention, too. Of course, I never had any such thought when I began to work on this, but I sort of stumbled across those numbers. And what that's an extension of, by the way, is to go back to the Vietnam experience, also that commonly said still today that 30 to 50% of Vietnam veterans suffer from PTSD. That never squared with, again, the figure that only 15% of Vietnam veterans saw combat. So there's just a huge slippage in there between what's documentable and what is claimed. So the same kind of thing then began to dawn on me with Iraq War veterans, and it really came down around the IED explosions and Humvees. So I pose this question, even if all of the survivors of that explosion indeed had a verifiable diagnosis of PTSD, that's still way off the ratio of what we have now of there being 20 for every one who is killed. Of course, I'm in no position to say this is not possible, but I raise that as a way of saying that we need to think more critically about those kinds of numbers, and we need to think, and this is then what I do in the book, I think about other reasons why or how might it be that we get those inflated figures of PTSD, of claims to PTSD, when the apparently documentable experience is way far from those numbers.
Going back to something you said just a moment ago, I'd like to spend some more time with. You talk about the media influence, and we did reference that earlier, but perhaps more detailed specifically with traumatic brain injury. You quote one as saying communication of stress equals culturally determining the outcome.
Yes. Well, you might be referring there to the British study on that. Laurie Grinker was her name, and her conclusion is that war trauma is not universally experienced. That's really, really important when you think about PTSD being what I call a socially constructed diagnostic category. One of the things that you would look for then is whether or not the commonness of it varies by societal or cultural context. So if you have war veterans from different societies, do they seem to experience TBI or report TBI or PTSD at a different level in those contexts? And they do. The British soldiers home from Iraq report about a 1/4 rate of PTSD, as do the American soldiers. From that, she concludes, and I think rightly so, you really can't avoid the conclusion that there's got to be a cultural thing in there. Otherwise, why would it be for the British soldiers different than it would be for American soldiers? So it really underscores, again, one of my basic contentions, which is that PTSD is fundamentally a socially constructed diagnostic category.
Well, this rings true when reading a very important part of your book, and that is juxtaposing the events that occurred with Woodruff. We just mentioned his injury in Iraq.
Right.
And subsequent book he and his wife Liz wrote. It wasn't much later that a CBS reporter, Kimberly Dozier, was injured as well.
Right.
Much more severely injured in many aspects, but she took it completely different and refused to take the victim stance.
Oh, absolutely. Again, we have something, a wonderful opportunity for comparative studies, which, you know, a lot of good sociology and a lot of good anthropology is really based on these kinds of accidents of history that give us these opportunities. And this is really a kind of godsend for comparative study. And that's the way I try to use it in my book. And you're absolutely right about a couple of things there. Her injuries were way, way worse than were Bob Woodruff's injuries. And when she wrote her book, she says in the introduction, throughout the book, she says it in a variety of different ways, that she just refused from the beginning to be cast as a poster girl for war-related trauma. And when her doctors try to apply that diagnosis to her, resists it. She doesn't deny that there is trauma and that she had the effects of that. But what she resisted is the idea that she has to go into her own future as that label defining her and defining her experience. So that's the book that she wrote. And then very interestingly, again, a contrast with Bob Woodruff's book, went to the number one bestseller spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Kimberly Dozier's book got very, very little attention in the media. It did get reviewed, but the reviews were not very prominent. It pretty much got lost right away. And I think, now this is my voice coming through, I think the reason is because her book not only didn't fit in with what the media had really been putting forth for the last almost 10 years by the time her book came out, but it certainly did not fit in with the way that the media had treated Bob Woodruff's book. It was really discordant with the media voice that the Americans had been hearing for several years, and with the way the Woodruff's book was presented.
I think that is key to what you're talking about, because it is a situation of the media, as we discussed a moment ago, possibly creating all of this expectation of deployment and injury, and then mirroring it back on itself.
Oh, absolutely right. The key word there is expectations, for sure. And she says outwardly, very boldly, war veterans have the problem of having to meet the expectations of their loved ones and other people for having come home wounded. and having come home damaged. And that was something that I tried to emphasize in part one of this interview. And she just comes right out and says that the problem is one of expectations. And what was really the crowning moment for this comparison for me is the C-SPAN program, Book TV, had her on as an author, and they used as an interviewer Bob Woodruff's wife, Lee Woodruff.
Which feels, as you say, a bit incestuous.
Oh, my goodness. A terrible call, I think, a terrible thing to have done for Kimberly Dozier, because Bob Woodruff's wife, from the very outset, was presenting these as two very different voices on PTSD. The way I watched that program, I would say it was a bit antagonistic as it went along, and Kimberly Dozier, true to form, just refused to be drawn into this narrative that because she had been wounded in Iraq, then she must be suffering from PTSD. And Lee Woodruff would lead her, right, as in leading the witness, and try to get her to say that, yes, she continues to be traumatized and so forth, and Kimberly Dozier just would not go there. It really is, I mean, for your listeners who are interested in this, it really is a must-see kind of interview. For the purposes of my book, is really the punctuation point on what I'm trying to say.
The similarity, too, is that in the case of Dozier, she was opposing the system's hard, fast rules. In essence, you're doing the same thing, which a person hearing the opening of our discussion in part one is going to say, wait a minute, now PTSD is real. You're not arguing that it is not. It is just, how real is it?
Not only how real, but what is its reality? You're absolutely right that I do not say that it is not real. The question is, what is the reality that it has? And how does it come to have that reality? And why is there this tension between what I think is its cultural and political reality and the diagnostic reality? And to see and to identify that tension that is there, I think you could tell by just what I've said here in part two of this interview and kind of the examples that I've used. The Lori Grinker example from the British study, this comparison of Woodruff and Dozier in the way their stories develop and in the way the press treated those two stories. That culture is just written all over this thing, that really you can't really think very meaningfully about what PTSD is and the meaning that it has in American culture today than to see it as a cultural category. And again, not denying the role that it plays in the diagnostic world, but then seeing that role in a very different light, perhaps seeing what it means to put the label on people, which is the way I think Kimberly Dozier was seeing it. She did not want that label put on her. And we need to ask why not, and to understand why she saw that labeling as something that she did not want to have to deal with.
There was the aspect, too, that she felt like this was something akin to a signature wound that she was not signing on to.
That's right. And that term signature wound has been applied to TBI in particular, that it is the signature wound of the war in Iraq. The news people picked up on that. It was actually a retired military officer who I think first used that term, but then the military picked up on that. That's a cultural expression, right? A signature. Think about the word signature. Something is signed. Something is signaled. And we need to think about, okay, so what is that? What is it that is signed or signaled by the use of TBI, by calling TBI the signature wound of a war? That's a cultural expression. That's almost a literary expression, right? It's certainly not a medical, not in the first instance, a medical expression. So there again, you have something. I have a way of saying, think about that as being a form of culture.
Sociology professor and Vietnam War veteran Jerry Limke, his book is PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. You can check out his work at Holy Cross College in Massachusetts, holycross.edu. We'll continue this discussion in just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. I'm Guy Rathbun with Professor Jerry Limke. His book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America.
I couldn't help but think of my own impressions when I'm watching television, the commercials come on, and I've read doctors responding to those commercials, especially pharmaceutical offerings of diseases or disorders we weren't even aware of prior to the advertising. The one that comes to mind is restless leg disorder.
Sure.
Suddenly the medical profession recognizes this disorder, but it wasn't before the ad came out, and now people are calling their doctors asking for something for treating of their nervous leg disorder. So you quote this one pharmaceutical scientist as saying the terms, before there were drugs, these conditions didn't exist.
Right, that was quite a find too. Although yeah. I had no doubt that something like that was out there to be found, but to hear, you're right, you know, a scientist saying before there was a drug, there was nothing for the drug to treat, right? The existence of the drug itself brought into existence the drug, and that was true. The context of that, I guess, was for something PTSD or TBI related. I'd actually forgotten that that's in the book. So there is that need to find something physiological, something bodily, something physical that we can grab onto as a way of talking about and thinking about PTSD. Something purely psychological doesn't seem to be very welcomed when we're talking about men and wartime experience. You know, people, Americans maybe in particular, are reluctant to think that war can have lasting psychological effects on people. So we go in search of something physiological. And I think that's where the TBI thing comes in. The reach for something physiological like the brain injury that can be seen or understood as being a result of something that is traumatic. Thus, the welding of the word traumatic to the word brain injury. So there's something there that's trying to be established in the way that we think about and in the way we talk about and the way we write about what happens to men in war.
Clearly, looking at some of the diagnosis and treatment that's going on, you in fact refer to one physician in this portion of your book where he is expressing in so many words anything but psychological. We don't want to look at it as psychological. Find something physically wrong. Use an MRI to do so if you need.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that search goes all the way back to World War I, at least. And the reason why shell shock really got the imagination of so many people, because people needed to believe that there was something external to the veteran himself that was causing these symptoms. The idea that fear itself, and particularly not even fear of war, but fear of one's own failure, could cause some kind of paralysis, some kind of bodily paralysis, a truly psychological or psychiatric kind of phenomenon. And so people, doctors included, you know, reached for shell shock, something happening outside the body. And again, that's the kind of thing that I think is happening with the TBI. What TBI does, what shell shock purportedly did for war veterans during World War I, TBI now is that external thing to the veteran himself or herself that accounts for the problems that the veteran coming back home is having.
I can only imagine that there are those who are going to be very critical of your research and work, but if they look at the specifics and the information you have been able to provide with an even hand, I think you're going to gain some ground with this.
Well, I hope that's true, but I think you're right. I mean, the book might run into the same kind of barriers as Kimberly Dozier's book. You know, it might be the greatest fear of all authors, right, is to be ignored.
Yes.
Because it doesn't fit into the dominant discourse. It doesn't fit into the dominant paradigm. It's discordant. And better for something like that to try to just kind of push it off screen. That's not a prediction. I'm getting an interesting number of email from people who haven't even read the book yet, but they look at the table of contents and they look at the chapter titles, and I'm getting responses that say, this looks like something that we've really needed, or I've looked at your chapter two or three or whatever, and I really think that you're on to something there. So I'm getting these kind of, you know, bits and pieces, and I'm not getting critical responses. I mean, maybe those are taking the form of just not saying anything. But it's a little bit too early to know just yet. But I'm encouraged by what I'm getting so far.
It seems like it would be a hot-button issue, but if someone would like to get a prelude to your book and your purpose behind it, they could go to that C-SPAN interview with Woodruff and Dozier, and I think that will be a tremendous lead-in, because what happens between the two of them, and I've only read the excerpts of that from your work, is very telling.
That's a good idea. Sometimes I think I should have started the book with something like that. You know, it might have worked very well, but strategies with writing books are you know, hard to know what will work and what won't. But again, I think that the interview is right. There are also some things online. I've posted some things on Counterpunch that are excerpts from the book. There's a couple of pieces on National Catholic Reporter's webpage that are good. One of those entitled Medicalizing Dissent, you and I really haven't touched on that, is really very important. You know, the way in which, by medicalizing something, you know, by medicalizing veteran dissent, is a way of discrediting veteran dissent. And that, of course, I think was done big time with Vietnam War veterans.
Yes.
And then the effect of that really has carried over into the current population of veterans. And people can come home from these wars from Iraq and Afghanistan and feel very uncomfortable about those wars, feeling discontent about those wars, some feelings about maybe wishing they had never gone. It's very easy for the society to say, well, something happened to you while you were over there, you know, and that goes down a road into trauma discourse. But another road to go down is simply political and the legitimacy of those feelings of dissent and not thinking this war is right and feeling uncomfortable about my participation because it's a war maybe that should not have been fought. And for a while, Vietnam veterans had that discourse through Vietnam Veterans Against the War and through there being an anti-war movement. But the current generation of veterans don't have that so much. It's a little more problematic for them.
Well, Jerry, I sincerely appreciate what you're doing and encourage the read of this work for enlightenment. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on your show.
It's such a pleasure. Always enjoyable reading your research.
Well, thanks a lot.
All the best.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Professor Jerry Lemke, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. Check out his website at holycross.edu. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rothbun.